God, please help me set aside everything I think I know about myself, my disease, these steps, and especially you, for an open mind and a new experience with myself, my disease, these steps, and especially you. Well, tonight we're starting the first of about 12 weeks going through the book, and I'd like to introduce Chris.
Hi, everybody. My name is Chris, and I am an alcoholic.
Hi, Chris.
It's really good to be here. You know, when David first came up with the idea of putting this meeting together, I thought it was such a great idea. Workshop meetings, not every meeting in AA should be a workshop format. This is kind of an unorthodox format where one person shares for a number of weeks on the literature. But I think they're incredibly beneficial. They add a lot of clarity to the recovery program. And if I do my job here, I'm going to add some encouragement also for people to gain a new experience and go out and do this recovery program maybe yet once again. And every single time that I've gone through the 12 steps, it's brought me to a better understanding, better ability to help other people, better personal relationships, better everything in my life. I start to be able to get out of my way and stop shooting myself in the foot. As an alcoholic, I'm pre-programmed to shoot myself in the foot. You know, I don't know about anybody else's experience as a drinker, but you know, we're great starters. You know, we look really good the first quarter mile of the 1 mile run, but somewhere along the line we change our mind or screw something up or have to move out of state or whatever. And you know, what happens when I adhere to these spiritual exercises and spiritual principles? What happens is my life seems to go pretty smooth, and I'm able to maintain the things I need to maintain and move forward on the things that I need to move forward on. That's a benefit. I would do this stuff just to not put alcohol back in my body, but. You know, one of the great things about the recovery program for alcoholism is it adds quality to every aspect of your life if you practice this stuff. Now, you know, a little bit about Alcoholics Anonymous, a little bit about alcoholism. Alcoholism has been around since people crush grapes. They learned, you know, there's writing on the cave walls 5,000 years ago showing, you know, people crushing grapes. I mean, we learned how to make alcohol a long, long time ago, and since that time, there has always been a section of the population who have a hard time with it, who get into trouble. Personally, you know, I've paid attention to some of the science over the years. I'm less interested in defining the problem scientifically than I am in engaging the spiritual solution. But I paid attention enough to know that alcoholism is a genetic bullet. It's not causal. You know, if you drink yourself into alcoholism, if you drink yourself into alcoholism, it's still a genetic predisposition for unusual metabolizing of alcohol. You know, that's actually good news because we're not scumbags because we're, you know, we didn't become alcoholics because we're scumbags. It happened to us because of a genetic predisposition. And the more recent science is continuing to prove that. There's a test that they're working on right now that will give you within a 2% probability of whether your child is going to be alcoholic when they're a baby. You know, you can do these genetic tests now. So, you know, that kind of stuff just leads me to believe that it's not causal. It's not because I'm not equipped to deal, even though I wasn't. So anyway, alcoholism has been around a really long time. It's unorthodox as an illness. Today we view it, this book views alcoholism as an illness. In 1956 or 57, the American Medical Association came up with the statement and the position that alcoholism is a disease, drug addiction is a disease. That's fine. I believe that, but I'm not gonna state that as fact here because an illness is, I think, a better description. We're ill. when we have alcoholism. We're ill in many, many ways. We're ill spiritually, we're ill physically, and we're ill mentally. And some people even added another fold to disease emotionally. I agree with all that stuff. It all makes sense to me. But it's an unorthodox illness. It doesn't make a lot of sense. Why can't you drink normally? Why can't you just have a few? I can have a few. What's wrong with you? How it presents, how alcoholism presents is with an inability to stay away from it for good and for all on your own unaided will, with an inability to control it or control and enjoy it when you're drinking. And then there's a dash. After the dash is unmanageability. And unmanageability is both outward, you know, the DUIs, the families that leave, but it's even more internal. It's emotional. It's psychic. It's those torturous feelings that we seem prone to as alcoholics, and it's an unorthodox illness. The professionals don't know whether to treat it as a mental illness. They don't know whether to treat it medically. There's pills. There's 15 pills under development right now for craving. These are craving drugs that if you take these drugs, when you start drinking, you're not going to get really drunk, supposedly. There's drugs that block your ability to metabolize so you don't get drunk. There's a lot of efforts out there, professional efforts out there to deal with us, many in the harm reduction mode, not necessarily the spiritual recovery mode, because that's not the discipline of psychiatric or medical. But they're working on this. They're trying. They're trying to understand this. And, you know, this book basically says that barely a beginning has been made, you know, by these people on our problems. And I would have to agree with that, too. There was a period of time where I'm a board member of the NCADD. I'm a board member of an organization called C4 Recovery Solutions, who fly all over the world, and their sole purpose really is to improve treatment processes for alcoholics and drug addicts. And I've met some of the leaders in addiction treatment. The people that write the DSM-4 is the official book that describes our problem and then talks about a solution. It's a psychiatric manual. And, you know, I know the people that wrote that. I've met the people who own the rehab chains, who put together, you know, a lot of effort, you know, to really try to help us with information and networking. There's a million things that are going on. But I do have to tell you that I believe that it's in, you know, professional addiction treatment is in its infancy because it's not working. The outcomes are horrific with many of these treatment processes or treatment systems. So alcoholism is unorthodox. It presents in many ways that are hard for people to understand. You know, you stopped at the bar on the way home Friday night to have two beers with your buddies. Why did you come back Tuesday with one shoe? You know what I mean? Where does that come from? What is wrong with you? Has anybody in here been asked that question? What's wrong with you? I can't tell you how many people ask me that question. That question didn't even compute to me. What's wrong? What's wrong with you? You know, I would throw it right back on them. You know, I'm having fun, or you know, whatever. So alcoholism is unorthodox. The treatment for alcoholism is unorthodox. The best possible treatment that I believe is available is in this book, and we're gonna go over the actual recovery program that's in this book. I want to make very, very clear: there are many people in AA today who think going to a lot of meetings is working a program. Going to a lot of meetings is going to a lot of meetings. Working a program is following the instructions in this book. There's a lot of people in here who think going to a lot of meetings treats their alcoholism. Going to a lot of meetings is like, I'll describe it like this. Let's say you have cancer and you go to the hospital to get, you know, because they're going to help you with your cancer. It's Sloan Kettering or something, okay? You go to the hospital and you go to the waiting room and you sit in the waiting room and you talk to other people who have cancer and you find out about their cancer and you share your problems about your cancer. But you never get intaked in to get the procedure. You never get the radiation or you never get the chemo or you never get the operation. That's what happens in Alcoholics Anonymous a lot today. People are showing up at meetings expecting that to be a transformational experience for them. When really what the meetings were designed for was it was designed for us to keep encouraging each other that we definitely want to make a commitment to sobriety and we want to encourage each other to continue to practice the recovery process. That's really the best practices of AA meetings. And again, a lot of people who are alcoholic come in and sit in the waiting room, you know, day after month after year, expecting recovery, and they don't get it. And then they leave and they say AA didn't work for them. Right now, more treatment professionals than not don't recommend us anymore because of the statistics that happen out there with our recovery. They will do a study. They'll stand at the door, and some graduate student or whatever is going to do a study for a psychiatric test or a, you know, for Yale School of Alcoholism or Brown School of Alcohol Studies. And what they'll do is they'll ask every single person coming through the door, how long you've been sober, you know, blah, blah, blah. And one of these surveys was published in the AA Grapevine about 2.5 years ago. And the statistics were 45% of the people had been sober less than 60 days that were walking into the meetings. That's a horrifying statistic as far as I'm concerned. You know, this process, the meetings, the steps, the service, has so much value for alcoholism that rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. That is still true. Even though these people taking statistics at the door are getting 6%, or the people that are going into multiple treatment, having multiple treatment episodes, that did you go to AA? Yeah, AA didn't work. And so, you know, so they're getting these statistics, and the treatment professionals are saying, one treatment professional said to me, I don't recommend to AA anymore. AA's statistics are 6%. I could get a better result with a placebo. And, you know, I was like horrified that someone who we go to and we pay a lot of money would say something like this and would not recommend people to AA. But what he sees is he sees the outcomes. He sees the statistics. Now, 6% is a true statistic, but it's also true that rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. The people that they're getting at the door who are blowing through the meetings are not doing this anymore. This has become unfashionable to go through this book, or even if you don't go through this book, do the best you can with the 12 steps. You know, put a moral inventory together. Share that moral inventory. Understand that your problems are greater than you. You need a power greater than yourself. Humbly ask that power greater than yourself to help you with these problems. Make a list of the people that you would harm. Actually go out and make amends to the people and institutions that you've harmed. Start the disciplines of 10 and 11, which are basically prayer and meditation disciplines. Practicing on a continuous basis what you learn here. And then go out and help other people. You know, go out and actually take other people through the steps. That's somewhere in the 50s or 60s that became unpopular. And the meetings became more and more popular. But the problem is the meetings do not generate the transformational experience that the recovery process generates. I want to read a few things here. Now, this is from the flyleaf of a fourth edition. It says, at the time of the third edition in March 1976, the worldwide membership of AA was estimated at 1 million or more. Copies of Alcoholics Anonymous in circulation was 1,450,000. Now, you know, remember that number. There was less than 1.5 books in publication for every recovery. Now I'm going to jump ahead to the forward to, I think it's the second edition. Bear with me. Not the second edition, the third edition. Not the third edition, the fourth edition. I don't even know what edition. Anyway, it talks in one of these forwards about how many books were printed. I think the 30 millionth AA book was given to someone at the last international convention. It was presented to some hero in AA. Now, we have somewhere between 2 and 3 million AA members today. So you have 30 million books, and you have 2 to 3 million people. So now, basically, you have 10 books out there for every one recovery. I find that interesting. I think people paid more attention and took more ownership of their books in the early days. In the early days of AA, there was two groups. There was Akron and New York, and then Cleveland popped up. Now, again, in these forwards, I'm not going to sit here and read word for word every single part of this book because I fall asleep when people do it. And so, but I know this book well enough to be able to misquote it really well. Now, you had New York, where Bill Wilson was doing his best, working in and around the Oxford Group until the Oxford Group threw him out around 1937 or so. And he formed the Group of Drunks. And there wasn't a whole lot of recovery there. What they did was they basically admitted their alcoholism, did a very, very brief, you know, movement through what is now today the step process, and then they went and they found other alcoholics to work with. And, you know, for whatever reason, maybe it was Bill's personality, there was not a lot of recovery in the first 3 or 4 or 5 years in New York. There was a huge amount of relapse. Now, in Akron, it was different. Dr. Bob followed the Oxford Group recovery process very stringently. Now, he didn't take a long time to take you through the steps. He worked with about 15,000 alcoholics in 15 years. So that's basically taking 3 people through the steps every day, you know, if you do the math. But he would get you on your knees. He would do a moral inventory with you. He would basically write down the character defects. He'd have you turn your will and your life over to the care of God. He would push you out there to make amends, and he would encourage you to work with other people and pray and meditate through the morning meditation and evening review on a daily basis. He was very, very specific about that. And so there was a huge amount of recovery in Akron. When they put the big book together and they were putting the stories together, the New York stories were people that were not sober very long. There was more stories from Akron, and there was longer-term sobriety in the Akron stories. So Akron seemed to be getting better results. But along comes Cleveland. Clarence Snyder and some of his boys move up to Cleveland and decide to completely break with the Oxford Group and start an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting because this book had just been published. And so they said, we're going to do an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. And that started in Cleveland. And they did crazy things like put ads in the paper. If you want to get sober, call Clarence, you know, with a big picture of Clarence. You know, like this. I mean, really, really, you know, stuff today that we would find unconscionable. But this was prior to really any firm traditions. And, you know, they were more about the business of spreading the message than they were about, you know, remaining appropriate in how they did that. When you look at the recovery rates in Cleveland, they paid very close attention to the people who were staying sober in the early days. It was about somewhere in the mid to high 90 percentile. Wow. So, So, you know, today where we have 6% recovery rate, Cleveland was getting 90%+ recovery rate. Now, that was for the people who would go through the recovery process, not people that would just show up in the meetings, but people who made a commitment and a follow-through and started to work with other people. Why I think this historical stuff is important is I believe that there's a renaissance going on today. I think it was started by Joe and Charlie. I think it was started by some of the Golden Slippers up in Canada. I think that there actually were people that were dumb enough to just use this book as, you know, as a tool, as a textbook and a tool to get sober over the years in different parts of the country. But again, in the 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, people had gotten way far away from this and got more involved in meeting maintenance and, you know, the 12 and 12 and, you know, other things, a lot of service and a lot of other things that were different than what they were doing in the early days. I think it's important to look back at what were they doing when they got that mid-90 percentile recovery. I suffer from alcoholism. It would be like, well, there's a hospital that has 6% recovery rate for your cancer, and there's a hospital that has 95% recovery rate for cancer. Where do you think, where would you go? Who would you pay attention to? I don't know about you, but I would. I'm interested in the stuff that works. I don't want to die an alcoholic death. My last 5 years of drinking was the grimmest, most decadent, most pathetic, most lonely, bleak, twilight zone type of existence that I've ever experienced in my life. And I just, you know, I'll do practically anything, you know, to stay away from there. So, you know, I got involved in some of the studies. And, you know, there's a lot of argument about this or that, you know, in the past because they didn't really keep great records and it's an anonymous program and this group was different than that group. And all of that's true. But in the main part, you can really see where in the early days they were doing something different. And in the early days, they were lower bottom alcoholics. You know, they weren't disco drunks. I mean, these were people who lost it all. You know, and were strapped up in 4-point restraints when they got drunk, and they were in mental institutions, and they were lobotomized. And I mean, you know, these are the type of alcoholics who responded to this. So again, you know, I don't think any of us in this room tonight are special alcoholics that this is not going to work for. You know, we like to think that our case is a little different. We like to think that, you know, yeah, we're alcoholic, but we've got other problems. We like to think all of that stuff because the alcoholic is grandiose and self-centered. But this is sufficient if you have alcoholism. What's in here is sufficient, and you know that's really good news. Bill, when he got exposed to this stuff, I think most of us in here have seen the movie My Name Is Bill W. or whatever, and understand a little bit about the story about Ebbie Thatcher paying a 12-step call on Bill. It wasn't called a 12-step call back then. It was called witnessing for the Oxford group. But he showed up and had a talk with Bill about I'm an ex-drunk. You know, I've found religion. I've found a spiritual way of life, and it works for me. That sunk into Bill in such a way that he started to actually practice this stuff. He started to actually go to some Oxford group meetings. You know, drunk as a hoot owl for a while, but he started to pay attention to this and see it as a ray of hope, see it as quite possibly a solution for his drinking problem, because Ebbie was just as bad as he was, you know. And if Ebbie could get sober, maybe he could. And he started to get involved in this stuff. And it talks in Bill's story, somewhere around page 9 or 10, it talks about him being on the hospital bed in Towns Hospital. And, you know, the wind of the spirit blew through him. And Ebbie visited him and acquainted him with his character defects. And, you know, all of that was basically the tenets of the Oxford group, which became our steps. But the most significant thing that happened during that stay that stay that Bill had in Towns Hospital was. The thought crossed his mind that there are millions of alcoholics dying out there every year, you know, thousands dying every day. If they could be exposed to what I was just exposed to through Ebby, the spiritual regeneration process, maybe I could save some lives. And he dedicated the rest of his life to helping us. I think I'm here tonight because Bill made that decision in 1934 or whatever on the hospital bed in Towns Hospital. There was a lot of people who got sober through the Oxford Group back in the day. There were a lot of people who got sober in the Oxford Group who wrote books about it. Bill Wilson is not the first person to write a book about getting sober who went through the Oxford Group. There are ones that that predate his by many years. Here's some of my favorites. The Big Bender. I Was a Pagan. For Sinners Only. You know, these are the names of some of the books that were written by early Oxford Group members, and they had stories in them about sinners and about drunks and who were able to change their life through the practice of these spiritual principles. So the spiritual principles are important if you're in real trouble from alcoholism. They really are. If you're not a low-bottom alcoholic and you've been able to maintain your sobriety just by going to a lot of meetings and doing some service every once in a while, you know, that is great. However, there's a scale in alcoholism, and it can get progressively worse. I've seen people who came into AA and were just, you know, barely bad alcoholics who relapsed after 15, 20, 30 years, who were just dead in a week because alcoholism is a progressive illness. So even if you are a high bottom or even if you haven't been affected by alcoholism that greatly, you know, this is something that you should pay attention to because you just never know. Sometimes not drinking makes alcoholism progress faster than drinking. Ask anybody who's relapsed after 6 months or a year who's been sober. Usually, they don't go back to where they were. They go back to, you know, where they would have been if they kept drinking or worse. That certainly was my experience. So in the early days, Bill Wilson was a wonderful alcoholic. I have the utmost respect for him, warts and all. Because you'll read some of the newer biographies and you'll find out that supposedly he was a womanizer and supposedly he was a shyster and all this other stuff. And, you know, I don't pay much mind to that. You know, we are alcoholics, and just by getting sober or even recovering from alcoholism does not make us saints. It doesn't remove all of the bad traits that we have right away. The good thing about Bill Wilson was he was a promoter. He would have been a great barker at you know, a carny or something. I mean, this guy could sell you. When he decided he wanted to go for money, he went to the Rockefellers. You know, when he decided he was going to have stuff published about Alcoholics Anonymous when there was 50 people, he went to the Reader's Digest. I mean, this guy was not fooling around. When it came time to do things, he went right to the top. He was fearless as far as pushing his agendas forward, and I think that helped us. I think that helped us in a great way. He was the tireless promoter of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I believe he had a lot to do with the spread of Alcoholics Anonymous around the world. Dr. Bob, the other co-founder, where I see his value. His value was sticking to the principles, reminding Bill time and time again that, you know, God is the power, not Bill. Reminding everybody again and again that there is a simple program of recovery. Let's keep our eyes on the ball. And you'll hear people say that if it was just Bill Wilson, that you would have been, they would have sold like Amway. And if it was just Dr. Bob, it never would have left Akron. And you know, there's some truth to that. I think we needed both of those personalities working in concert with each other to get to where we are today. There's a story in the back of the book. I just want to read a couple of paragraphs of it. I want to show you what it looked like to go through the steps with Dr. Bob back in the day. All right. This is from a story called "He Sold Himself Short," and in the fourth edition, it's on page 262. Starting on the bottom paragraph. A lot of people were sent to Dr. Bob because Dr. Bob was known as the drunk, the guy who could cure drunks. That was his nom de plume. People from all over the country had heard about Dr. Bob, and you would be sent to Akron Hospital a lot of times. You'd be sent to Akron Hospital, and Dr. Bob would put you through the four-hour treatment or whatever. And many, many times, you'd never drink again. You know, many times you would, but many times you wouldn't. It really depended on what your follow-up looked like, what type of participation you put in the things that he suggested to you. All right, bottom of 262. I stayed in Akron 2 or 3 weeks on my initial trip trying to absorb as much of the program and philosophy as possible. He's going to the meetings. He was hanging out with other drunks. The other drunks were telling him their story. He was learning what he could. I spent a great deal of time with Dr. Bob. Whenever he had the time to spare, and in the homes of 2 or 3 other people trying to see how the family lived the program. This was a family program back in the 30s. If you showed up without your wife, Dr. Bob would say, go get her. You know, we want her here. Maybe not in the exact room where people were, you know, sharing, but they saw alcoholism as a family illness even back in the 30s. Every evening we would meet at the home of one of the members and have coffee and donuts and spend a social evening. The day before I was due to go back to Chicago, it was Dr. Bob's afternoon off. He had me to the office and we spent 3 or 4 hours going through the 6-step program as it was at that time. This was they call it the tenets of the Oxford Group. I don't even know if that's accurate, but these basically were recommended spiritual exercises of the Oxford Group. There's a great book out there called What is the Oxford Group? And it was the big book of the Oxford Group. And these were in it. So if you join the Oxford Group, you usually got a copy of What is the Oxford Group? And it had these instructions in it. 1, complete deflation. We can see that as step 1, maybe even some of step 2. I can't do this on my own. I need help. Complete deflation. Dependence and guidance from a higher power. We see this as, you know, steps 2, steps 3, steps 6 and 7, you know, 11. We need dependence on and guidance from a power greater than ourselves. And it was really cool how they would do this. They would do morning meditation with a pen or a pencil and a notebook. And you would sit there and you would wait for guided thoughts in deep meditation. They saw deep meditation as contemplative, not... When the Maharishi came through with the Beatles, it changed all of our perception about what meditation is like, okay? Now we thought meditation was sitting there going, ooh, you know. That's not what meditation looked like in the 30s. In the 30s, it was contemplative. In other words, you'd read some prayers, much like the 24-hour book or something, and then you would think very, very deeply about that. You would try to concentrate on that. And then there would be a period of time where you would try to be still and you would try to get what they called guided thoughts. What a guided thought was, you know, you'd be sitting there and all of a sudden you'd think, I should bring Aunt Fanny a fruit basket, you know. And you'd write that down. You know, I should tell my boss to go screw himself. And, you know, you'd write that down. And after you came out of this meditation, you would share your guided thoughts with other individuals who had done the same thing, and they would say, you know, that boss thing probably isn't a good idea. But go ahead and get Aunt Fanny the fruit basket. That sounds good. And you would act on these guided thoughts. They believe that God spoke to us after a period of prayer, a period of meditation, and then you know, with the notebook. And they thought that God spoke to us through these guided thoughts. They really believed that. So when it says dependence and guidance from a higher power, that's what this guy is talking about. Number three, moral inventory. That certainly is our fourth step and part of our tenth step. Four, confession. We call it a fifth step now, doing a fifth step. But the Oxford groupers saw this as confession, confessing your weaknesses, confessing your sins, confessing the wrongs that you had done to others. They saw that as essential. Restitution. After a confession, you know, you put a list of people or institutions together that you had harmed, and you go out and you make direct restitution. And they were not kidding about this. It's become okay in Alcoholics Anonymous today to not actually go out and make amends. You will find people, if you ask enough people, you'll find somebody that'll cut you some slack on step nine. Well, I don't really think you need to, go back to Mrs. McGillicuddy, from fifth grade. You know, you'll find people that didn't do it themselves who will cut you some slack. But, understand in the early days, they were very, very serious about this. This was the thing that Dr. Bob balked about. Dr. Bob accepted everything except for restitution. And here's why. Dr. Bob was a proctologist. Everybody in here know what a proctologist is?
Okay.
He was a bad proctologist, too, because he was always drunk. And when he wasn't drunk, he was shaking. And the worst part was he had these big hands. Okay, so you'd be getting your proctor, done, and you'd be in the stirrups, and he'd come in stinking like booze, shaking with big hands. You'd be looking for a second opinion fast. So he was running out of proctors to work on. And he was about to lose his house. Now he thought that if he went around town and admitted his alcoholism and admitted the botched operations and the drinking in the emergency room, and, all the stuff that he would need to admit, he thought that he would completely lose his ability to support his family. This is back in the Depression and stuff. So he would not do it. He became convinced to do it when he got drunk on the way to Atlantic City for a convention. Because he always went to Atlantic City for the physicians' convention. I work with a lot of guys, and there was periods of time where I worked with a lot of newcomers, and I understand that they'll come to me, and we'll be working a program, or we'll be in the middle of the steps, and they'll say, well, I'm not going to be around for 6 weeks or so. I'm touring with the Grateful Dead. I always tour with the Grateful Dead, and so I understand he had to go to, because he always went. And when he got poured off the train on the way back, he made a decision right then and there. The worst part was, and you can read this in his story. The worst part was, what happened was when they poured him off the train, he was still drunker than a hoot owl. And he had an operation the next day. So they had to prep him for this operation. So they gave him a bunch of beer and a bunch of downers, and pushed him in there. Go, get your scalpel and go in there. And I've always thought that Dr. Bob's nightmare, the title to his story should be Dr. Bob's patient's nightmare. There's no historical record of this person who had his proctor worked on. When Dr. Bob was all, still drunk. But anyway, right after that operation, he understood that he had been holding back. He'd been holding back, and he basically said to himself, guys, I'm all in. I got to be all in. And he went up one side of the street and down the other, making his amends. And he never really was able to make enough money, to live on. Alcoholics Anonymous World Service had to help him for quite a while. I think his house was paid off at one point in time by, people. He never really made a living, but he did the same thing that Bill did. He dedicated his life to alcoholics. He had enough of a reputation left that in the hospitals that he was working in, they gave him rooms. And you would get brought to Dr. Bob, you would be put in a hospital room, and you would be 12-step not only by Dr. Bob, but by the boys. The boys would roll through, and each one would tell you his story, and then you would go through this process. So five is restitution. Six is continued work with other alcoholics. They called it witnessing in the Oxford group. You would go around, and Bill Wilson actually did this, actually stood on soapboxes on Times Square and proclaimed Jesus as the Lord. I mean, he did that when he was getting sober in the auction group. That was one of the things that they asked you to do in the auction group. He quickly saw that alcoholics didn't respond too well to that. I don't know anybody else. Have you ever got the knock on the door Sunday morning at 8 o'clock? You're still hungover. Hi, we'd like to talk to you about Jesus. Bam! You know, I mean, you know, we just don't really respond to that. I don't know what it is, you know, closed-minded or something. But he quickly saw that, you know, not necessarily witnessing in a very Christian way, but witnessing to the still suffering alcoholic that I was like you, I'm not anymore, I've got a way out, are you interested? And that basically became the sixth tenet of Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, it was in 1939 when the book Alcoholics Anonymous was being written that he changed the six steps to 12. I could imagine what the AA group said. You know, Bill, you just gave us six more steps. What the hell's wrong with you? You crazy? But, you know, 12 is a very spiritual number, and I see the brilliance in it. You know, the great oral tradition story is Bill was feeling under the weather, which he was really, you know, in his nature to feel under the weather and just pull the covers over his head. He did that quite often. But he was in bed this one day, and he knew he'd written the first two or three chapters. He'd written his story. He knew that he now had to talk about the recovery program. And he said he did a little prayer. He had his pencil and paper ready, and he started writing. And he said he kind of came out of this when How It Works was written. You know, the first, if anybody has the original manuscript or even earlier, you know, the first draft of How It Works, he kind of came out of it. He believed that it was divinely guided, and I think that's the case for me because it's sufficient. The 12 steps for me are sufficient to not only provide permanent sobriety if I continue to pay attention to them and continue to practice them as they're laid out, but they're sufficient for the recovery, the mental, spiritual, and physical recovery from alcoholism. They've been that way for me, and they've been that way for most of the people maybe all of the people that I've worked with. So, you know, that's a wonderful wonderful story. I love looking back on our history a little bit. I'm hoping that that'll give us a little bit of a foundation to start going through the book. You know, I hope I've made clear how important I think this book is. Without exaggeration, the workshops that I've done and the people I've worked with and the study I've done on my own, I've probably gone through this book somewhere between 400 and 600 times. You know, I know evangelists that haven't been to the Bible that many times, you know? Yeah, and I don't reread anything. You know, anybody that knows me knows that when I read a book, I give it away. I don't want it hanging around. There's been many reasons why I've done that, but every single time I go through this book, something jumps out at me. The definition of a spiritual classic is it hits you where you are. It speaks to you where you are, whether you have one day, 20 years, 50 years, whether you've been through this book 200 times, once, 800 times, it will speak to you where you are, and that makes it alive to me, and it makes it good news. You know, there's good news in this book for me. Now we have about 8 minutes left. Dave will be the question moderator.